From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a look at perhaps the most polarizing figure in the Bush cabinet, Attorney General John Ashcroft. We talk with journalist Jeffrey Toobin. His profile of Ashcroft is published in this week's New Yorker. Also, how the CIA is funding high-tech companies to develop new systems to identify and track terrorists, and why civil libertarians are concerned. We talk with journalist Jeffrey Rosen. His article, Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Secretary of State Colin Powell has arrived in Israel on a mission to bring about a ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinians. NPR's Mike Schuster is in Jerusalem.
Powell will meet with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon on Friday and with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat on Saturday in the besieged West Bank city of Ramallah. Powell spoke by phone with Sharon on Thursday. Sharon has resisted President Bush's call for the Israeli army to withdraw from Palestinian territories, saying Israeli troops will only withdraw when their mission to end the suicide bombings is completed. In Amman, Jordan, before traveling to Israel, Powell said the U.S. wants to see more progress toward an Israeli withdrawal. Israel did pull its troops out of more than 20 West Bank villages, but the army still controls the primary Palestinian cities, Nablus, Jenin, Ramallah, and Bethlehem. Little fighting was reported on Thursday across the West Bank. Mike Schuster, NPR News, Jerusalem.
White House News Secretary Ari Fleischer today denied a report in the Washington Post that President Bush's inner circle is questioning Ariel Sharon's fitness as a partner in peace. Post article says Sharon's West Bank offensive has undermined administration support for him, but Fleischer said today President Bush believes Sharon is a man of peace. The House today approved a bill reforming 28-year-old laws governing retirement savings. The legislation was spurred by fallout from the Enron collapse. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
It was President Bush who early this year issued the call for pension law reform, saying it was necessary to avoid the massive loss of retirement savings experienced by employees of the bankrupt Enron Corporation. And the bill House Republicans sponsored closely mirrored the president's plan, passing on a vote of 255 to 163. Ohio Republican Rob Portman was one of the bill's authors.
It provides more education, it provides more information, and it provides more choice to workers. That's what it does. All of that leads to more security in retirement.
Democrats failed to push through a more far-reaching pension reform. They complained that the Republican plan gives employers and executives far more protection than it does employees. Republicans replied that too much reform would discourage small firms from offering pension plans. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Ohio Congressman James Traficant has been found guilty on all 10 counts against him at his corruption trial in Cleveland. The charges include racketeering, bribery, and taking kickbacks for political favors. The 9-term Democrat represented himself at the trial, even though he's not a lawyer. He faces more than 60 years in prison, but will likely receive a shorter sentence. His sentencing hearing has been set for June 27th. The dollar gained on the yen but weakened against the euro as European currency benefited from rumors of a U.S. investigation into IBM's accounting practices. Gold prices were higher in New York and Europe. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 205 points to finish at 10,176, and the Nasdaq was down 41. This is NPR News. The head of South Africa's chemical and biological weapons program during the apartheid era has been acquitted of charges of murder, fraud, and drug dealing. Wouter Bassan had been dubbed by the country's media as Dr. Death. The BBC's Hilary Anderson is at the High Court in the South African capital, Pretoria.
Mr. Bassan was the head during the apartheid years of South Africa's chemical and biological warfare program, and he had been accused, and this is what the trial was about, of carrying out all sorts of quite extraordinary crimes, including trying to create deadly bacteria and anti-fertility drugs that would only affect black people, and of hoarding enough cholera and anthrax to start epidemics. The catalog of his plans reads something like a spy novel. He was said to have contaminated envelope flaps and cigarettes with anthrax, spiked whiskey with herbicides, and chocolates with botulism. All this in the name of fighting the apartheid government's political enemies.
The BBC's Hillary Anderson in South Africa. Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge met with members of a congressional panel behind closed doors for the second time in as many days today. Lawmakers want him to publicly discuss the administration's $38 billion request for Homeland Security. Ridge declined to appear before a committee, but met privately with the Government Reform Committee in the Republican-controlled House. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, a Democrat, today said Ridge's closed-door meetings with Republican-led panels in the House were not acceptable. Ridge has said his refusal to testify is based on a, quote, separation of powers issue. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 205 points. The Nasdaq was down 41. The S&P 500 fell 26. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Attorney General John Ashcroft got a big round of applause on the David Letterman show earlier this week when he sat in with the band at the piano and played the Beatles' Can't Buy Me Love. His approval rating is pretty high. Yet, as my guest Jeffrey Toobin writes, Ashcroft is the most polarizing figure in the Bush cabinet and the most socially conservative figure to become attorney general in many years. Toobin profiles Ashcroft in the current edition of The New Yorker. Toobin is a staff writer for the magazine and a legal analyst for ABC News. He writes about some of the controversial steps that Ashcroft has overseen in the war on terrorism, including the detention of more than 1,000 people on secret charges, the establishment of a new system for monitoring certain attorney-client conversations, and a plan to create military tribunals for alleged war criminals. But Toobin thinks that over time, Ashcroft's social agenda will be more controversial than his anti-terrorist measures. I asked why.
I think it's a combination of things. One is there is just such enormous support for anti-terrorism work across the political spectrum that just no one wants to take him on those issues. I mean, Democrats, you know, one of the things that I write about in this story is, you know, the Democrats got all worked up bringing him before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And once he got there, and this is last December, you know, they were meek as mice in front of him. I mean, this politically, all the advantage is on Ashcroft's side. Second, you know, I think in fairness to Ashcroft, some of these proposals have been somewhat distorted by their political adversaries. And they've moderated some of the proposals, particularly the military tribunals. When that proposal was first made, there was the possibility of death sentences on less than unanimous verdicts. There was no provision for an appeals process at all. Now, as the proposal has come out, those changes have been made. So I think there has been some responsiveness, not total responsiveness, to the concerns of civil libertarians.
And so you think he's going to be most controversial for which issues?
For his social agenda, for you know, the real fault lines of American politics. John Ashcroft, I mean, one of the fascinating things about going back over his long, long political career is to see that no issue has been more important to him than abortion. I mean, he is perhaps the most pro-life prominent political person in the country. It has been the key issue to his whole political career. The only case he argued in the United States Supreme Court was his defense of a Missouri law that required all second trimester abortions to be conducted in hospitals. He actually lost that 6-3. But I think, you know, that is not an issue he's going to give up on. He's worked around the fringes of it, but I think that's where the real controversy is going to be. In addition, he has also been an extremely outspoken opponent of all sorts of gun control, and he's starting to bring that into the Justice Department, and I think there he may have some particular problems because it runs up against his anti-terrorism proposals in certain areas.
Well, in fact, didn't he refuse to let the FBI check to see if terrorists had purchased guns?
Well, that's the thing that really is so extraordinary and that I write about in this story is that, you know, the Brady Bill, which President Clinton signed in 1993, establishes what are called audit logs for almost all gun purchases in the United States. And what the FBI did in light of September 11th and these hundreds of arrests that they made, they started to check those audit logs, see if any of these potential terrorists bought guns. Ashcroft shut that process down. He said, you can't look at these records. According to my interpretation of the Brady Bill, which was explicitly contrary to Janet Reno's interpretation, you cannot check those. Those records have to be destroyed within 24 hours. They cannot be used for investigatory purposes. I mean, here you have potential evidence of gun purchases by people that Ashcroft believes are terrorists, and he says, no, you can't look at them. Again, that was a complete interpretation of the law in line with what the National Rifle Association had been saying all along. And Ashcroft, as a life member of the NRA, as a longtime believer in their principles, even in the crucible of a terrorist investigation, said, no, you can't look at those records. I think that's the kind of thing that will be controversial in the future.
I imagine that Ashcroft's fervent anti-abortion stand connects in some way to his religion. What about his opposition to anti-gun laws and his support of the NRA? Where does that fit into his constellation of beliefs? What backs that kind of strong pro-NRA stand?
Ashcroft is from Springfield, Missouri, which is in southern Missouri. It's in the Ozarks. It's very rural. It's almost southern in its orientation, more than Midwestern, like a lot of Missouri is. And Ashcroft, in many respects, his political philosophy comes out of the sort of southern post-war, culturally conservative, libertarian in certain respects, but certainly not all respects. Politics that is very much taken over the Republican Party. The Republican Party is now a Southern and Western party where issues like gun control and abortion are really at the center of what people believe. And I don't think there's any religious basis for his position on gun control, but it is certainly strongly held in something that he's maintained for a long time.
As you point out, he's been accused of using his popularity from the anti-terrorism campaign to push his agenda on social issues like his opposition to gun control and his opposition to abortion. Did you come across any evidence that he's actually using his popularity now to push that social agenda?
Well, I think the most dramatic example of that comes in Oregon. Oregon passed what was called the Death with Dignity Act, which allowed, and I'm simplifying, some kinds of assisted suicide. And that has been a key tenet of the anti-abortion movement at the moment. Look, with Roe v. Wade on the books, there are only certain things there's only a limited amount that the pro-life movement can do on the issue of abortion. So they have adopted other issues, one of which is euthanasia, again, broadly defined. Ashcroft, in November, really at the peak of the terrorist investigation, reached out and said to Oregon, I am not going to let you enforce this. Again, contradicting or changing a policy of the Reno Justice Department because he views it as contrary to federal law. That was an example of him serving the pro-life constituency. Another example is, people may remember, that in a Nebraska statute was struck down by the Supreme Court, I believe 2 years ago, that banned what some people call partial birth abortion. The court said you couldn't ban partial birth abortion. Well, Ashcroft's Justice Department in Ohio went to court to say a slightly different partial birth abortion bill should be upheld in Ohio. You know, these are all issues at the fringes because that's really all you can do with Roe v. Wade around. But certainly he is going to fight for ways to advance what he's believed in his whole life.
You point out that Ashcroft's allies say that he's restoring the Justice Department's reputation, a reputation that was tarnished by Janet Reno. What do they think he's doing to restore the Justice Department's reputation?
Well, thinking back way, way back to the Clinton administration, Janet Reno was caught up literally for years in basically what was a single controversy, which was whether she should appoint an independent counsel to investigate Clinton and his administration on campaign finance reform. It sounds like it's from another century now, and it actually was, but it was just an endless hot controversy where Reno would be hauled before Congress, whether it was before Henry Hyde's committee or Orrin Hatch's committee, and just beaten up on that issue time after time. There is no similar controversy now. Now, I don't want to revisit the merits of that old controversy, but certainly there is not this sustained political attack on Ashcroft that there was on Reno, and I think Ashcroft is the beneficiary of that.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He profiles John Ashcroft in this week's edition of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Toobin is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and legal analyst for ABC News. He has a profile of John Ashcroft in the current edition of The New Yorker. John Ashcroft is a very religious man, and his religion seems to also inform some of his political and social views. What church does he belong to?
He belongs to the Assemblies of God, which is part of the Pentecostal movement. It's actually, it's fascinating. It's best known today for rather unfortunate connection. It was the church of Jimmy Swaggart. It was the church of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. But it was actually, it was only founded around the turn of the century when it was very much kind of a grassroots movement. It was racially diverse. It's no longer. It gave opportunities to women to be preachers in a way that many other denominations didn't. Amy Semple McPherson, who was a famous California minister, was part of the Assemblies of God. And Ashcroft literally grew up with that movement. His grandfather was an itinerant minister who really didn't even have his own church, who traveled around the country in a 1921 car, preaching on street corners. Ashcroft's father, Robert Ashcroft, was one of the people who brought the Assemblies of God closer to the religious and cultural mainstream. He founded or participated in founding three churches affiliated with the Assemblies of God in Springfield, Missouri, where Ashcroft grew up. So Ashcroft's life has been part of Assemblies of God remaining a little bit of a kind of outsider movement. I mean, it is an evangelical movement where people speak in tongues and things like that. But it has become much more mainstream, in part because of the efforts of people like his father.
Was John Ashcroft, the now Attorney General John Ashcroft, was he always religious?
Always religious. But interestingly, his father had one foot in the secular world. Robert Ashcroft, the Attorney General's father, tried to become a chaplain during World War II. And he was rejected because the Army had a requirement that you had to have a college degree. The Assemblies of God operated sort of independently of educational institutions in those early days. And he said, look, that's got to change. We've got to bring the Assemblies of God into the mainstream. We've got to go to have colleges that have serious academic requirements. We've got to, you know, preserve our religious affiliation, but also become part of the mainstream of American life. And he brought that philosophy to his son. Robert Ashcroft said, look, I'm going to have a very religious household, and they did. But John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, he always went to public schools, and he won a scholarship to Yale. And his father, even though Yale was a million miles away socially, politically, culturally from the Ashcroft world in Springfield, Missouri, he said, you go. You've got to be able to keep a foot in both worlds. And I think John Ashcroft's career has very much been in both worlds. He is a serious cultural conservative, but he's also a very accomplished politician.
After John Ashcroft graduated from Yale, he got a scholarship to Chicago Law School. Then he returned home to Springfield, Missouri, set up a law practice. How did he enter politics?
Well, he was a summer intern for his local congressman when he was at Yale, and the congressman retired. soon after Ashcroft graduated from law school. And it's interesting, it's very much a replication of his father's career. His father brought the Assemblies of God to the educational world when the Assemblies of God had actually sort of shunned formal education. Ashcroft, in the early 70s, didn't know a single politician who was a member of Assemblies of God. There was also a kind of shunning of that process. But he said, look, we should join the political world as well. And he decided to run for Congress. He ran in a Republican primary in 1972, and he lost. But then, in a weird, weird pattern that has held true for Ashcroft's entire career, his loss for Congress turned into a terrific victory for him, because instead of being a congressman, he was appointed state auditor of Missouri by then-Governor Kit Bond, and so he became the fourth-ranking elected official in the whole state.
What was John Ashcroft's record as the governor of Missouri?
He had a record of considerable popularity. It was pretty good times in Missouri during that era, mostly in the 80s. And he I think was somewhat frustrated, because his real issues that he's always cared about were the social issues like abortion, and there was only a limited amount he could do on those, and he was caught up in budgets and the kind of things that governors usually deal with. And I think he was very anxious to move on to different things after two terms as governor.
And he moved on to senator, U.S.
Well,
senator.
There was another defeat in between. After his second term as governor, he ran for chairman of the Republican National Committee and lost. Had he won, who knows what would have happened. But because he lost, he was again at loose ends. And in 1994, John Danforth unexpectedly resigned from the Senate, opening up that seat. So for the third time in Ashcroft's career, when he lost for Congress, when he lost for state auditor, then when he lost for RNC chair, a defeat turned out to be a victory.
Ashcroft opposes gun control. He's a lifelong member of the NRA. How much backing over the years has he gotten from the NRA?
A lot. He during the 2000 Senate campaign, which was really an epic of modern politics, where he ran against Mel Carnahan, who was then the incumbent governor, the NRA contributed, I believe, $35,000 directly to his campaign, but also spent more than $300,000 on independent expenditures for Ashcroft. So he has been a strong favorite of the NRA, and he's repaid them in kind. Of course, this is the Senate race that ended in this extraordinary way. Mel Carnahan, the governor, was killed 3 weeks before Election Day in a plane crash, and Ashcroft then lost the election by 50,000 votes. To Mel Carnahan's name was on the ballot, though the then governor said he was going to appoint Jean Carnahan, his widow, to the Senate, which he did.
This is another example of Ashcroft winning by losing.
Well, that was the fourth Congress, auditor, RNC chair, and then senator. And it's interesting, you know, when I asked him about these losses turning into victories, he kind of laughed about it and said, you know, my brother says about me, you're so lucky, if you fell into the sewer, you'd come out eating a ham sandwich. Well, I mean, that's pretty funny. But when he describes this experience to religious publications, as he has many times, he says over and over again the same thing. He says, you know, these defeats, they were crucifixions, and the victories, they were resurrections. Now, there are not many people in public life who would describe their own experiences as crucifixions and resurrections, but that is how John Ashcroft thinks, that's how he talks, and I think it's an interesting insight into his character.
What did you learn about his wishes for his political future and other people's plans for his political future?
Well, he told me that he was retired from politics. I asked him very explicitly, are you going to run for president in 2008? He said, oh, I'll be 66, I'll be too old. I said, come on, Ronald Reagan was older than that when he ran. And he looked at me and he said, I knew Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was a friend of mine. I'm no Ronald Reagan. Now, that was a pretty funny line. I have to give, you know, I give him credit for that. It was also a less than categorical denial of political interest. And, you know, as I talk to people in Washington, I think there is a growing sentiment that if Dick Cheney is unable to run for re-election for health purposes, Ashcroft would be a real possibility as his replacement. And I think if he were to get that, he would become, of course, the presumptive frontrunner in 2008. And, you know, I am far from the only person that has occurred to.
What's his popularity level now in the American public?
Well, it's really just extraordinary, Terry, when you think about it. I mean, here's a guy a year and a half ago who lost to a dead man. Almost, a little more than a year ago, he was confirmed as attorney general with 42 votes against him, the most ever by against an attorney general candidate. And here he is today with a 76% approval rating. You know, he's on David Letterman. He's speaking all over the country. No one's booing him. No one is, when he appears in front of Congress, he gets very gentle treatment. It's been a remarkable political resurrection, to use his term.
You interviewed Ashcroft for your profile of him in The New Yorker. Is there anything that particularly surprised you about talking to him in person?
Yes, actually. You know, he presents a very forbidding presence in public, you know, when he's testifying or speaking. But in private, he's much lower key. He's very self-deprecating. He's actually has a very pleasant manner, which did surprise me. I mean, he's, you know, very homey. You know, I remember he said to me at one point, you know, there are only two things you need in life, duct tape and 10WD and WD-40. You need WD-40 for things that are stuck together that need to come apart, and duct tape for things that are apart that need to come together. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that means, but it was kind of appealing, you know?
You have to hang out at hardware stores a lot to get that.
Exactly, yeah. You know, it's showing that Missouri thing. I remember I there was an appearance he did not too long ago with Ed McMahon, who was sponsoring some Neighborhood Watch commercials. And Ed McMahon introduced him, of course, when you think about it, as "Here's Johnny," which is not exactly what you think about with John Ashcroft. And then Ashcroft said, "Gosh, we used to watch you every night at 10:30. And I thought to myself, gosh, he's such a Midwesterner. You know, those of us on the East Coast always thought of Johnny Carson on at 11:30. But by golly, he was on at 10:30 in St. Louis, and that's what John Ashcroft was going to say.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Always a pleasure.
Jeffrey Toobin's profile of John Ashcroft is published in this week's edition of The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Ashcroft with his former group, The Singing Senators.
My baby is American made, born and bred in the USA. From her silky long hair to her sexy long legs, my baby is American made.
Everything I buy today has got a foreign name. From the kind of car I drive to my video game.
I got a Nikon camera, a Sony color TV. But the one I love is from the USA
and standing next to me. American made,
oh yes she is.
Born and bred in the USA. From her silky long hair to her sexy long legs, my baby is American made.
She looks good in her tight blue.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how the CIA is funding high-tech companies to develop new technologies that would identify and track terrorists, and why civil libertarians are concerned. We talk with Jeffrey Rosen. His article, Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Silicon Valley is reinventing itself as the new headquarters for the military technological complex, according to journalist Jeffrey Rosen. His article, The Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. He writes about new technologies and database systems that are being developed to identify and track terrorists, how the CIA is funding some of these efforts, and why civil libertarians are concerned. Rosen is an associate professor at George Washington University Law School, legal affairs editor of The New Republic, and author of The Unwanted Gaze, The Destruction of Privacy in America. Let's start with an overview of the investment the CIA has now in the Silicon Valley.
The CIA has started this very interesting venture capital firm called Incutel, and the Q stands for the character from James Bond. It was the idea of George Tenet, the CIA director, and the idea is to invest about $30 million a year in internet startups and young companies on the theory that technologies that were useful before September 11th for profiling, monitoring, and recording customers on Amazon might now be useful for profiling, monitoring, and recording and identifying potential terrorists. But because it's a regular venture capital firm, the technologies have to be commercially viable, and indeed the companies negotiate the sale of their technologies for national intelligence purposes, but the main idea is to have them useful in the commercial sphere as well.
So who is the head of this new company, Incutel?
He's a very interesting character called Gilman Louie, who was one of the most successful games manufacturers of all times. This is the man whose first big success was Falcon, which is the air simulation game, which was so popular not only with teenage boys, but with the Air Force, that it used it to teach fighter pilots how to fly real jets. But then his big success was a couple of years ago when he imported Tetris from the Soviet Union. And Tetris, of course, was the most popular computer game of all times. It sold 70 to 80 million copies. And he told me that Hillary Clinton loved playing Tetris on the Game Boy. So that was very exciting to him. And Gilman Louie was marketing Hasbro's computer game site a couple of years ago in 1998 when he was approached with a very unusual offer. And George Tenet, the CIA director, asked him to head this interesting new company called Incutel and to go swimming in the valley to try to persuade the internet entrepreneurs to play ball with the CIA.
Why do you think somebody whose specialty is computer games was asked to head up Incutel?
Well, he said very frankly, he said that the CIA actually thought that my computer game background was a valuable asset because I look at the world as one big system, one big game. I actually hadn't seen these things, but he described to me Falcon, which is an extraordinarily complicated and realistic effort to simulate not only gunfights and dogfights, but also geopolitical strategies. There are all sorts of other political and simulation choices to be made. So in this sense, he thought that what the CIA is doing now in the real world is very similar to what he had done as a game developer. He also has a knack for fighter technology himself. He's an amateur fighter pilot, and I think met the CIA recruiter in a dogfight that was sponsored by a computer magazine to see who was the top dog among business executives. So it's the combination of the military background and the idea of seeing the world as one big system that was very appealing to the CIA.
Now, you say that the CIA wants the Silicon Valley to develop technologies that have been used already for identifying, profiling, and tracking potential customers, and to use these technologies to identify and track potential terrorists. Give us a sense of how that might apply, how that might work.
One of the most promising examples is the use of technologies that had been deployed to detect credit card fraud and to use that to create profiles of potential terrorists. So, for example, people who study these things tell you that credit card fraud often fits a consistent pattern. People who steal credit cards will use them at self-service stations to test that they're okay, and then go out to try to buy clothes at the mall. So if you fit that pattern, you're likely to get a call from the credit card company. Not long ago, the Federal Aviation Authority announced that it had started up a partnership with two companies called Accenture and HNC to use this same technology to create profiles of potential terrorists. And indeed, Brett Ogilvie of Accenture told Business Week that their system will ask if you've made international phone calls to Afghanistan, taken flying lessons, or purchased 1,000 pounds of fertilizer. And based on this information, personally identifiable phone calls and credit card information, the system will try to create a profile of potential terrorists to see whether you look like the terrorists of September 11th. And if you do, for example, if you're a retired businessman who took flight lessons in Florida, you might set off an alert. There'll be yellow alerts for intermediate questioning and red alerts for more intrusive questioning. And based on this technology, the FAA hopes to be able to nip terrorism in the bud.
In order for this technology to work, there's a lot of databases that would have to be interconnected so that so that the FAA could tap into all of these and get the information that we're seeking about potential terrorists. What would it take to connect those databases?
Well, this is absolutely right. The first thing it would take is a relaxation of our privacy laws, because indeed several federal laws restrict the amount of personally identifiable phone information and credit card information that can be released to the government except as part of a specific investigation. It's hard to tell from this system exactly what information the government proposes to include in the database. And indeed, when I called up Accenture and asked them, they said that national security prevented them from divulging what the factors are. I tried to explain that I wasn't interested in what the profiling algorithm was, which would allow perhaps a potential terrorist to beat the system, but only wanted to know if they were proposing to include in the database information that's currently restricted by law, but they stuck to their script and refused to say.
Is there any division among civil liberties activists about whether this kind of trade-off is worth it to help stop terrorism, or about whether this type of centralized database is going too far in infringing on civil liberties?
There is indeed. There's a very lively and interesting debate. The first question that's raised by these profiling technologies is the simple one of whether or not they work. And there seems to be a consensus among the civil liberties community, at least, that this particular profiling technology is unlikely to identify potential terrorists, mostly because the sample of known terrorists is so small. We're really talking about profiling 19 terrorists of September 11th out of 300 million people. You're looking for a needle in a haystack, one civil libertarian described to me, but the shape and color of the needle keep changing. And indeed, statistically, when you've got a very small sample that you're trying to profile, it appears very difficult to create a reliable algorithm. So the first objection of civil libertarians is skepticism about whether or not this particular technology is likely to be effective. A more substantive concern has to do with the dangers of centralizing information in a single database to begin with. And indeed, this was the galvanizing cry of civil libertarians during the last great debate over privacy in the 1970s, and when President Nixon did propose to survey Vietnam protesters, and when the government in the late 1960s proposed a single national database that would unite information from the CIA and from the Labor Department and from a whole series of federal departments. Vance Packard, the great sociologist, wrote a celebrated article for the New York Times Magazine, which became his great book, The Naked Society, in which he warned of the dangers of a centralized database, which would give great power to the government to track, classify, and discriminate among American citizens. So it was really a fear of that centralization that led to the passage of the Privacy Act of 1974 that forbids government from lightly sharing information without good reason. And it's partly for that reason that information is shared in a lot of different places. So civil libertarians are very concerned about the danger of centralization.
My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His article, Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His article, Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. It's about new technologies and databases being developed to help identify and track terrorists, how the CIA is funding some of these efforts, and why civil libertarians are concerned. Let's look more at what's being done to create new databanks and to centralize databanks in the hopes that it would help find and track terrorists. Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, wants to consolidate state and federal databases into a single database. And apparently that's, I guess, what Oracle does is create databases, or at least one of the things that Oracle does.
They do indeed. They're the world's largest database manufacturer. As Ellison described to me, your profiles on Amazon are kept in an Oracle database. Your Yahoo profile is in an Oracle database. Your airline tickets and all sorts of information about you is stored in Oracle databases. And Oracle itself learned about the virtues of centralizing databases about 7 years ago in 1995, when Ellison said that he realized that his company was suffering great inefficiencies because different information was stored in different databases. So the German office couldn't talk to the French office, and prices varied across the globe. Ellison says that by centralizing Oracle's own databases on the internet and making them accessible in one place, the company saved $1 billion a year and found it easier to track and monitor and discriminate among its customers. And he says that the U.S. government would enjoy similar efficiencies if it centralized all of its disparate databases in one place. He complains that the problem after September 11th was that there were too many databases sprinkled out over different places. So the authorities at the INS didn't know that Mohammed Atta had a warrant out for his arrest in Florida. Ellison has offered to donate the software for a single integrated database to the government for free of charge, although he says that upgrades and maintenance wouldn't be free. And he stresses that this would make it easier for the government to share information about terrorists and would also create more reliable profiles. He's suggested the adoption of a digital identification card, which would be optional for citizens but mandatory for aliens. And he wants to collect a biometric, a fingerprint or an iris scan, and store it in a centralized database, which would be linked to the card. And this would make it possible both to make sure that people really are who they say they are at important checkpoints like airports and the border, and also to run background checks to find out whether there's something seriously wrong in their past. So we could find out whether there are outstanding warrants for their arrests. If someone is a deadbeat dad, they might be stopped at the airport. And Ellison says that this would be a very effective use of technology for fighting terrorism.
Do civil libertarians have any specific concerns about that biological identification, either scanning the iris or using a fingerprint?
They do indeed. Civil libertarians recognize that different designs for biometric technology pose different threats to privacy. So Larry Lessig of Stanford explained to me that the most intrusive architecture for an identification system would be the centralized storage of a fingerprint, because this would make it possible for the government to do what's called one-to-many matches. In other words, you could go to a protest scene, for example, dust for fingerprints, plug the fingerprints into the central nationalized database, and figure out everyone who was at the scene. Or you could do the same if you were in a restaurant, dust on a glass and see if someone is having an adulterous affair. Civil libertarians say that it's possible to design an identification system that would be less intrusive. If the fingerprint is stored on the card itself, for example, this would make possible a one-to-one match, confirming that I am who I say I am, rather than showing that I'm actually Jeff Rosen. And this would make it more difficult to engage in the kind of identification of strangers that civil libertarians are concerned about.
I want to ask you about another database security system that Oracle is working on, and this is a system designed to identify early on outbreaks of suspicious diseases and to provide early warning signals for biological warfare attacks. Would you describe the system that Oracle's developing?
It's a very interesting system. It's called the Lightweight Epidemiology Advanced Detection and Emergency Response System, which stands for LEADERS. And this is designed to collect healthcare information from emergency rooms across the country and to look for suspicious patterns. So at 9:20 a.m. on September 11th, the Oracle head of the healthcare consulting unit got a call from the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, which feared that the attack on the towers might be followed by a biological attack. He worked for 10 hours and he input all of the information about hospital beds in New York State into this system. He pulled up a screen, which could be pulled up in Atlanta, which has mapped every underground pipe, sewer, and water line in the city with 7,500 digital photographs. It's an extremely detailed architectural map. And using this system, this allows hospitals to report incidents of suspicious diseases like anthrax and Ebola in advance. They can send out email alerts to law enforcement authorities, or voicemail can go out automatically. And by collecting this data and engaging in syndromic surveillance, as it's called, it's an effort to look for unusual syndromes, Oracle hopes to be able to find early evidence of a biological attack and to get some help.
Is this system in use already?
My sense is that at the Twin Towers, it was not, because by the time the system was up and running, they found to their distress that there were almost no casualties. It was all fatalities. So, and thankfully, there was no biological attack. But the system is indeed at use in large public events, such as presidential inaugurations, and I think also at the Super Bowl. So it has been deployed in several circumstances already, and they're hoping to expand its use so that, as Oracle said, every hospital, every clinic, every lab in the country is going to have to participate. This will be a bioterrorism shield.
Any civil liberties questions about this database?
Well, there could be, of course, if the information were personally identifiable. We can easily imagine the dangers of a centralized genetic database in which the government could get personally identifiable information about our genetic predispositions and use that either to deny us insurance or to make other sorts of predictions. I should stress that the Oracle database is designed not to be personally identifiable. This is syndromic. It doesn't have my name on it. And I think, as best as I understand the architecture, the fear that this information might be linked back to individual patients right now is unfounded. But there obviously could be dangers. And this distinction between a broad syndromic surveillance in which patterns are detected in ways that are not personally identifiable, and by contrast, personally identifiable surveillance in which information can be linked to particular individuals, is the main distinction that civil libertarians insist on when they evaluate these consolidated systems. It's much less distressing to look for large patterns of behavior than it is to try to pin behavior on individual people. Another example of syndromic surveillance that Oracle is experimenting with is the use of similar technology to detect patterns of crime in the city of Chicago. It turns out that there's some logic to crime outbreaks, that on certain days with certain weather patterns and certain sporting events, you can predict with relative precision that there'll be outbreaks of crime in particular aspects of the city. So using this Oracle technology, the city of Chicago has dispatched more police officers to particular parts of the city when the technology suggests that there are likely to be outbreaks. And like the leader's epidemiology technology, this is not personally identifiable. It's not like they're predicting that a particular person is going to commit a particular crime. And the City of Chicago Police Department says they've been happy with the results of this system.
My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His article about new technologies being developed to track terrorists will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His article about new technologies and databases being developed to help identify terrorists, how the CIA is funding some of these efforts, and why civil libertarians are concerned will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Now, we started our conversation talking about how the CIA started a venture capital company to invest in Silicon Valley companies that might help create technologies to help identify terrorists. Has that CIA-backed venture capital company, InQtel, invested in any of the database projects that we've been talking about?
The CIA has invested in a series of companies that engage in profiling that is similar to the technologies we've been talking about. And I can tell you about some of them because I talked to them as well. One of them, for example, is a company called IntelliSeek, which has what might be described as a search engine on steroids. It's a kind of Google that can even get more than Google can do, because it engages in searches of the invisible web, information which is not archived. But this technology instead goes to the individual search engines themselves and engages in a deeper kind of search. IntelliSeek, with the help of InQtel, is hoping to dispatch its technology at airports so that when you check in, you'd be essentially Googled or IntelliSeeked, and you'd plug in your name, and both the chat that you might have engaged in and also any other references to you on the web would come up. Other kinds of search technologies that IntelliSeek has invested in involve the use of geographic maps. There's a company called Metacarta, started up by a MIT graduate student, which, again, can do a kind of Google search that is linked to a three-dimensional map of the area. So I can put in Terry Gross and find on a map of the United States any web pages that might be associated with Terry Gross in a particular area. A final series of technologies involves not only data mining, but also knowledge management. And the goal of these technologies is to solve what InQtel and the technologists call the Tower of Babel problem. How is it possible that we have all of this open source information available on the web, but it's very difficult to make head or tails of it or to organize it into ways that can be useful for intelligence? So, for example, technologies that had been used to organize resumes so that companies didn't have to read through all of them by hand are now being deployed to organize information on the web in scores of different languages and to monitor chat rooms to see whether an Osama bin Laden chat room has unusual updates. Mohamine and other companies like it are able to scan chat rooms in many languages and to find out what people are saying about the United States government and use this to create usable intelligence. So all of these are different applications of business intelligence technologies in the national intelligence sphere designed to solve the Tower of Babel problem. And based on the CIA's increasing conviction that the most useful intelligence is open source intelligence, you don't always need spies. You can just go onto the net. But the problem is that there's so much information on the net that we need technologies to organize it and make it intelligible.
So, Jeffrey, who will decide what the limitations are on access to data in these databases? You've got the people working on the technology who want to connect databases. You've got the government who seems to want to connect databases, too, and a lot of civil libertarians who object to it. How will this be resolved?
This is a very troubling question, because when I asked it to the technologist, they would say repeatedly, "We just build the machines. It's up to other people, the customers or the politicians, to decide how they should be used." They said, "Go talk to the politicians." Then when I went to talk to the politicians, I talked to Maria Cantwell, who's the most technologically savvy member of the Senate. She complains that she can use her spittoon on the Senate floor, but she can't use a BlackBerry wireless communicator. And she was concerned about the fact that the politicians feel that the technology is so unfamiliar that they are reluctant to regulate it. And she said they really are not very technologically savvy. She explains to them, "You're going to be able to go into your car and say, 'Take me to the nearest Starbucks.'" And they say, "Well, that's great." And then she says, "Well, but there'll be a record that where you were in 2 a.m. in a database." And they become more recalcitrant. So I'm concerned, as she was concerned, that the technologists are not eager to regulate themselves, that the politicians are too afraid of the technology to regulate it, which leaves the courts. And Lawrence Lessig of Stanford was pessimistic on this score. He said there's no court that will stand up for heightened review for privacy. We almost need some kind of privacy commission similar to the Environmental Protection Commission, said Lessig, that would evaluate the effect of a particular database on privacy. But given our current legal strictures, he feared that that would not be done by judges. So all this suggests that there's a big challenge ahead, which is to try to recreate in this new age of databases the checks and balances that we took for granted under our 18th and 19th and 20th century constitution. And it's going to be important that each of these groups, the technologists, the politicians, and the courts, do their part in reconstructing these checks and balances.
You visited several of the companies that are developing this software to help track terrorists. What was the security like at the companies that you visited? Since they specialize in security, they must have pretty good security in their companies.
That's a wonderful question. Actually, in Teleseek, it was pretty low tech. It's a building across the way in Roslyn, Virginia, and there was this nice security guard downstairs who asked me for an ID, and I actually didn't have one, so I showed my plastic gym card and just went right up. It was one of these pro forma things. But once you get up to their office, there's a very cool Star Wars process where you type in your name and get a name badge with a barcode, and you have to turn it in when you leave. That was impressively high-tech. The best one of all was at Oracle Corporation, which has a very elaborate ID card which can track where you are in the buildings at all times. But even at Oracle, you know, human discretion will always trump. It's impossible to get a parking space at Oracle. You have to look around for about 30 minutes, and even though the company is the leader in tracking and predicting consumer behavior, it can't quite find enough parking spaces for its employees. But I went in and talked to the nice security guard, and he said, okay, I know you, no problem, I could have the illegal spot. And there was a lot of that sort of informal interaction where it's people who were actually known and had forgotten their ID cards were waved through. So this goal of completely technological tracking may be a little bit overstated.
Well, Jeffrey Rosen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen's article, The Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Rosen is an associate professor at George Washington University Law School. His book, The Unwanted Gaze, The Destruction of Privacy in America, has just been published in paperback. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. Also by Audi. In performance, technology, and design, the goal remains constant. Never follow. Information available at AudiUSA.com. And Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of A Cup of Light by Nicole Mones, a novel set in modern China by the author of Lost in Translation. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview and performance with the eccentric singer and musician Tiny Tim on what would have been his 70th birthday. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.